Okay, so today is November 12th, 2016. This is our first lecture of our sixth year of giving history. First of all, I want to thank Harvey for really setting everything up, and everything you see here today has Harvey like all over. I guess you have to apologize.
That's very nice, but I don't give the lecture, okay? I do the easy part.
We have to apologize. What happened is you know, we have this very big, large screen that we set up. We can't find the screen. As a matter of fact, we have 2-3 people looking over the building now, all over, just finding the screen. So the option was, we had a few options, but we thought that this would be the best one. Okay, well, you let us know if it was a good option. Different years. Last year we ended in the middle of the 1300s. So this year, I guess we're going to pick up around this time. What I find is a challenge from this point on is that there's like, well, few things, but one thing is that things start to interconnect. You know, it was very simple when all the Jews were in Israel, and all you had to worry about was Israel. And then they all went to Bavel, and what did you have to worry about? Just basically Bavel. When we went to Spain, so they were basically, we focused in on what was doing in Spain. And last year we already went back and we started again from Europe, European history, and we started from the fall of Rome, 476, and we got into the 1300s, so we covered roughly about 1,000 years. However, there are a few gaps and a few areas that we want to maybe start to connect. So that's one challenge. It's like a 3-ring circus going on, 4-ring circus, 5-ring circus. You got a lot of things going on all over the world. Also, you have a lot of history, like written history. You know, from the time of the second base of Megdash, you had Josephus, and you had maybe, 2-3 other historians writing. And even through the Gullus Bavel, there wasn't too much. We had from our writings, but now already there's a lot of history. There's a lot of things that are being written in all these different areas. So there's a lot more information that's out there, and even more specific information as opposed to just general. So I'm having my challenge is finding what to focus in on. What I would like to start off tonight, sort of like an introduction, which I guess you'll forgive me, but if I do something a little different. And that is as follows. There is a number of years ago, probably about 20 or 30 years ago, there were these from religious scientists in Israel, and they wanted to know, how can we prove the Torah with proofs. Like modern-day proofs. Can we prove what the Torah is? And they said, okay, what would we need to prove the Torah? And they sat down, and they came basically about this certain course, and it was originally known, I think, as Arachim, which is even today. And the Eishet Torah has gotten involved, and it has different names. It's a discovery program. So what I was thinking of doing, just maybe as an overall theme, is just maybe starting with this idea of showing how they prove the Torah, and just focusing in on one area which is related to us, and focusing in on I'm going to give you just a general outline on how they, all the proofs, and then I'm going to just focus in on the 7 wonders of Jewish history. And I'll explain what that is in a second. And I would like to just more focus it in on our period of time, basically European history from the 12th and 13th century. That's basically what I had to do. So I'll give you just a quick overall view, overall of what Arachim is. I've never given such a class, but, you know, and then go be more specific in. Okay, so let me just say like this. I remember when I went to this class, I remember how the lecturer started. He said, in those days when I took it, it was Iraq, but now it's really Iran. He says to us, you're here, we're in a room, and we just got intelligence that Iran is their reactor, their nuclear reactor. They just got the shipments of plutonium, and the plutonium is gonna come in, and within 1 week you have, let's say, 2-3 days to go ahead and blow up the facility. And if you don't do it now, then there's going to be plutonium radiation, and it's going to be a mess, big problem. So you are all here. What would you have to know that the information you got is correct? And that's the idea of being also is that how do we know that the information of the Torah is correct, that it came from somewhere, and how do we know it now? So without going into all the major big proofs, but one thing is the message that it got to us, how did it get to us? How do we know that it wasn't brought in by from somebody else? Or how do we know it wasn't? So one thing is the codes. This is where the codes would come in. And the codes were, you know, we know that this Torah came from Hashem, and we have these codes embedded in them, and it's just statistically impossible for all the things that they're finding out in there to know, to say that this is other than this cannot be a man-made document. It had to have come from Hashem. So if you got something from your spy from within, and it has the right codes that are in there, you know, you could rely on it. Okay, that's one way they do. The second thing they do is something called identifying information. Let's say this could really be, let's say, one of two things. Either let's say you see from somewhere else that plutonium was shipped from you got outside, you know, you got another information that it came from somewhere else, or let's say how do you know it's coming from your man inside? Maybe it's coming from from somebody else that you don't know. So what if he comes in and he says, you know it's me because I parked a blue Chevy on the corner in Dizengoff Square on this and this street and this and this block. And if you know that there's something that no one else could know except your guy in there, then you know it came from your guy. Right? So the same thing is with Hashem. Like if Hashem gave something like he tells you that there's only three animals that chews its cud and does not have split hooves. He's telling you from the entire world you'll never find other than these three animals. Or the other way, the pig is the only animal that chews its cud that has split hooves and doesn't chew its cud. So he's like giving you all these identifying information. He didn't have to. He's volunteering this information. So that, again, you know that this document is telling this. If it's not true, then that's it. It's not. But he's volunteering information. He doesn't have to. Fin, you know that if a fish has fins, you know it has scales. But, you know, and we've never found a fish with fins without scales. So, okay, that's the second thing. The third and the fourth or more have to do with us. This is outside verification. This is what I meant before. Let's say you find something, you find in our, you know, you want to, the plutonium, you know that there was a shipment of plutonium that was sent from some other place, and you have outside verification that you see from satellites, certain things that are moving. So you're not only trusting your spy, your source, but you're getting outside information. Here it could be archaeology. Everything that we found in archaeology has supported the Torah. And the last one, which more has also to do with us, is control. What if your spy, how do you know he really has access, your spy has access to the sensitive information, the important documents and information in the nuclear reactor there. So he says, you know what I'm going to do? I'll show you that I'm in control. At 3 o'clock in the morning, Tehran is going to have a blackout for 3 minutes, from 3 to 3:03. And sure enough, there's a blackout, 3 to 3:03. In other words, he's showing that he has control and he can do things, and you would realize that his information is real. And again, Hashem does that with terms of control. One of the things that show control is something called the seven wonders of Jewish history. What are the seven wonders of Jewish history? So most of the seven wonders of Jewish history all come from the Tochacha, from the curses that are in the Torah. The Torah makes predictions. It makes prophecies. And it tells that when the Jews are not behaving well, they're not doing what's right, and they go into exile, a number of things are going to happen. And it brings down, there are seven prophecies that are going to happen about the Jewish people. And the prophecies that are going to happen either are statistically impossible, it shouldn't exist, and second is that they contradict one another. In other words, if one is true, then maybe two and three shouldn't happen. Three happens, and what about four or five? Like, things in a normal pattern should not really exist. Do I have everybody on this? Is this, yep. Did I, okay, any questions? I mean, okay. So that, this is, so in the large scale of proving the Torah, in control, we're showing that how Hashem has control, and we're showing that he's telling us this is what Jewish history is going, this is what's going to happen to the Jews when they're in exile, and we're now going to bring Pesukim, and then we're going to show the examples. So let's say just the seven, first the Pesukim that says that the Jews are the eternal nation, okay, that they will live forever. I guess the fact that we're still here, that already shows that we're here forever, but okay, that's one thing. The second thing is that there will be exile and dispersion, which already is, if you're going to say an eternal people with exile and dispersion, not too many other nations still exist and have been through exile and dispersion. Let me see how many there were. After Israel, there is no one. So, okay. So
you name it. Oh, you're saying there's nobody.
There's nobody, right? There has yet to be another nation that has been exiled and has remained as a nation in of itself, maybe for a short time, but usually they all get assimilated into the host nation that they're brought into. Okay. The next one is also that they're few in number. So, having a few in number is not good odds to keep a nation going. You know, okay, you want to say you have a lot of people, so you're all over, but you're all numbers, you all meet each other, so you're everywhere. So that would also be a contradiction, so to speak, to being an eternal nation. It would make sense if you're exiled and dispersed to be few in number. The fourth one is anti-Semitism. All right? So, again, to be an eternal nation, that means you'd think, okay, so maybe everybody loves the Jews and they want to help them and they'll keep them and they'll preserve them and they'll give them all advantages and all nice things. But that's not what happens. So, the fact that we're an eternal nation and that there's anti-Semitism is also adds to the fact that, wow, this is an eternal nation with exile, dispersion, few in number, and anti-Semitism. Number five is that now this is really tough. It says, we'll get into some of the, is that we're going to be a light for the nations. What is a light for the nations? We will have an influence on the nations. Now, I mean, like, if you just want to say there's, what, how many, would say about a billion Muslims and a billion Christians, would you say? And both really start from our religion. I mean, there's a lot. I have a few more examples. But just even of that, monotheism. Wherever the Jews were, there's monotheism, as opposed to the Far East, where the Jews were never in large numbers, and they still have they're still in idols. So here, now, could you imagine how could the Jews be a light to the nations when they are few in number? They're exiled. They're all over. They don't have a. There's anti-Semitism. They hate them and yet they're going to be a light to the nation. So it's like pretty, pretty remarkable. So if you were to make such a prediction of a people, it would be just like impossible. Like why? Who would make such a prediction? You know. The next is also the interdependence of the Jewish people in the land of Israel. Now, what does that mean? Basically, it means that when the Jews are living in Eretz Yisrael, the land blossoms. And when the Jews leave, that's it. Nothing happens. They can't. It doesn't go. I have a few examples, but you know, we don't even need to. We've seen it with our own eyes. You know, just what was and what is. Now, who can call that? How can you control that? You know, these people are on it, the land's going to flourish. These people are not, it doesn't. That shows total control. And the last is that the return of the Jewish people to the land of Israel. So that's also an amazing prediction, and the fact that it happens. Again, never has happened before, and we did it twice. We did it twice. 70 years, and now we're there again after almost 2,000 years. Okay, so this is what they, when, if I would be giving a lecture in the Arachim, in Discovery, to people that, you know, to give proof to the Torah, this again, this is a part, see the Arachim, they do it, they, you know, in Israel it's a socialist country, so people can take a week off, so they give it for a week. In America, they have weekends, so you get it down to about, holiday weekend, you can get a Friday, a Saturday, a Sunday, you know, Shabbos, Sunday, and then they go ahead and they give these, like, little parts to it. So this is what I was just going to, before we get into the history, because a lot of this does play out, and you see this, stark reality in our time as well. Just to go through the quickly, eternal nation. The Torah says was in this week's parsha or next week's parsha. After Moses, B'si Beni Benechaz Arachaz Arachaliyaz Leam Lekim Lezarachach Aracham, and it will be an eternal covenant. Okay, there's the pasuk. We also have it in Vayikra and Dvarim. And it's come true, and we have not had a homeland, common language, shared history, and yet we are still here. So that's amazing that here we are in this time. There's a cute story that I saw just to show in terms of an eternal nation. Hitler was, I don't know if it's true, but it could have been true. Hitler got up before he became chancellor, before he became, you know, and he gets up in these pubs and he starts saying, you know, how he's going to take over Germany and he's going to get rid of the Jews. And at one of the meetings, there's a Jew in the back. And after everybody stops clapping, this Jew keeps clapping and clapping and clapping. And like Hitler thinks that this Jew is mocking him. He says, "You don't believe me?" He says, "Of course I believe you, but you're not the first one." There was a Paro, and after Paro we got Pesach. And then there was a Haman. The Haman we got Purim, and then there were the Greeks, and then we got Hanukkah. But you hate us more than all of them, so when Hashem defeats you, it's going to be the greatest holiday. So now, you know, we don't have a holiday yet for that. You know, unfortunately, it's still wounds. But we're still here. But you go to the eternal nations, Egyptians, the old Egyptians, Babylonians, Persians, Greeks, Syrians. These were nations that were like superpowers, and I don't know why I don't have Rome up here also, but they had the entire civilized world, everything. That's it. And where are they today? That's the idea. And the Jewish people, we were exiled without, and here we are, and here we are now. There's no holiday. The reality is the Jews are still around. For 2,000 years we've been tortured, persecuted. Again, this is the same idea that I've been mentioning. Tolstoy, if it means people, means, I don't know, Tolstoy's a big historian. Jew is a symbol of eternity. He's the one whom they were never able to destroy. Bloodbath, afflictions, fire, sword. They guarded the prophetic message and transmitted it to all mankind. The people such as this can never disappear. The Jew is eternal. So if it's not enough that the Torah said it, Tolstoy said it. So that Okay. Number two is exile and dispersion. So again, just quickly, just going through the psukim. This is basically in this is the Tochacha in Vayikra, and then it says Jews are and I will scatter you. This is in Hebrew, but in English, I will scatter you among the nations at the point of my joint soul, leaving your country desolate and your cities in ruins. And the Jewish people were exiled from Israel in 586. They survived, came back after 70 years. Again, the only nation exiled twice, and the only nation to ever survive and return from a previous exile, and we did it twice. Nobody has ever done it even once. People generally disappear, and not only that, but it also says I'm going to exile you to the four corners of the world. And not like you're all only... only exiled to one country. So you're right, in the beginning, maybe the first one only exiled to Babel, you know, a little went to Egypt, but you find wherever you are, you'll find Jews all over, you find Chabad, Okay, so it's again just a bearing out of the Torah, the proof that the Torah said it, and what it did. And I'll scatter you among the people. This is another pasuk. This is in the Tochacha of Devarim. Not that, but it says also, you will find no repose, not a foot on ground to stand on. You will be sent from land to land. So the way they do this is that this is, you see, look at that. The Torah called it. You know, this is mamash, a prophecy in the Torah that has come true. Torah goes on to spell out one final uniqueness with the phenomenon among these nations. And, okay, fine. These are just a few of the exiles that the Jews have been. 250 from Carthage, okay, I guess you could read, from Alexandria, Clermont, France, Visigoth, Spain, Empire, Italy, Sands, Mainz, France, Germany, England, France, 1293. This is where we were ending last year. Then this is where we're going to be getting to more in Germany now, Switzerland, Germany, Saxony, Hungary, Belgium, Slovakia, Strasbourg, Germany, and France, and wait for it, from 1420 to 1498. I mean, what the Jews went through from, let's say, 1492 to 1498 in a series of 6 to 8 years. You know, the amount that, you know, just in the places. It wasn't like small little places. You're talking all of Spain, a good part of Italy, Lithuania, Naples, Portugal, Nuremberg, Navarre. There will be a few in number. So that works with the last one. If you're going to be exiled again, so you will be a few in number. How do you see in Jew? How do you know that we would be a few in number? Maybe every nation from our history would have the same amount. So what they do is they do a comparison with another country that had, another nation that had the same amount of people as we did in the past, and then what happened since then to us, and what happened to them. So in Egypt, there were 611,730 adults, males, that would be from the age of 20 and up, right, over 20. So that's not including females, so double it for the amount of females, because that's what the... And then who's lower than 20, usually in a healthy society, have more people, more kids than adults. So it comes out, it's not unreasonable to assume that coming out of Mitzrayim, there were 3 million Jews. Okay? Census Davidic recorded 1,300,000 males. So if you did the math again, you know, David's census, which is about 500 years after coming out of Mitzrayim, so we went from 3 million to about 5 million. The number of exiles who returned from Babel, we know Ezra records 442,000. Now, Tacitus declares, I guess this is, I'm guessing this is the, declares that Yerushalayim at its fall contained 600,000 persons. Josephus, it's a different report of 1,100,000 people were there in Jerusalem at the time of the destruction. First of all, the numbers of Josephus are inflated. All historians say that generally the numbers are inflated, I know by him or by later. But it was also Vespasian's army came right before, I believe it was right before Pesach. So there were a lot of Jews that went Ola Regel. So So there were a lot more Jews in Yerushalayim that got stuck in there before. So even though there may have been a lot more people, Jerusalem itself was, may not have had permanent residents that many. But there was about, I guess, between the two, there's somewhere between 600,000 and a million people. Hadrianic Wars. This is Bar Kokhba. So they say about 580,000 Jews were slain, according to the first century, which is about the same. There were 1 million Jews in Egypt. So getting the idea on how many Jews there were. Okay, the Romans had about, in the Roman Empire, there were about 8 to 10 million Jews. That would have been about the 3rd or 4th century. Okay, if in the same period of time the Chinese had the same amount, went from a population of 30 million to over 1 billion, it should be approximately 500 million Jews. Okay, so if you get the proportions, here's a nation in their land, not exiled, not hated, not persecuted. In a long term, there were people that came in and conquered China, but it wasn't... there were virtually no more Jews in the world today than there were 2,000 years ago. And yet throughout this time, Jews remained a distinct people. Again, few in number. Now we're getting to, after the Roman Empire, Benjamin and Tudela, he made a trip. He started in Spain, traveled the world around. He came up with about 1,050,000. But he put like 100,000... in Persia, another 100,000 in Arabia, 300,000 to a place called Thanium, which we don't know where it was. And he said he gave numbers to places that he's never been to. So they assume that it was somewhere between, this is about, again, 1170, somewhere between 500 and 700,000 Jews at the time. In 1290, 16,000 Jews were expelled from England, 100,000 from France, 200,000 from Spain. By this time, by the 16th century, in Germany, it was only left where these were the four big communities. From everything that there was, Frankfurt 2,000, 1,000, 10,000, Prague, Vienna 3,000. By this time, most of the Jews had moved to Poland in the 1400s already. Beginning the end of the 1300s, 1400s, that's the migration to Poland. So Poland is going to be... One thing we also have, it doesn't mention here, is that Hashem promises there's always going to be a safe haven. There'll always be a country that will accept the Jews. When Spain kicked out the Jews, Turkey, the Turkish Empire said, we'll take them all. Bavel, the Yerushalayim. Between 380,000 Jews, between the years 100,000 and 59,000, you've got to realize from here, you're talking Crusades, you're talking Black Plague, you're talking blood libels, host desecrations, expulsions and whatever. You have about 380,000 Jews, about a million Jews. 16th, 17th century, okay. 1300s, 2 million. So you get the idea that we've been keeping them about the same. If you're going from millions of Jews in terms of we should have, I guess, this many, this is how much we have today. About 16. We're now about, I guess, over here. Before the Holocaust, we had about, I think, about 16 million. And now, since where we are today, we're somewhere between 15 and 20 million Jews today. Relatively, again, that's the idea, just to prove the point that we're few in number. Now we go to anti-Semitism. Again, the Pasuk says, these are psukim, you won't find rest in wherever you go, and you'll be, your eyes will be weak eyes, and you're davening torturous soul, make you cowardly, destroy your outlook, make life hopeless, you'll leave constant suspense. Okay, so these are psukim again in the Tochacha that says what's happened. Now, we're the only country, we're the only nation that gets its own term, anti-Semitism. It's like no other country. You know, every year there's a specific anger and hatred for Italians. Each one has their own thing, but the whole world is a phenomenon. So, anti-Semitism can be broken down into four parts. Just go through this quickly, but universality, everybody. Is like, is no place intensity, the amount of hatred, the longevity. It's not just a short time, it's long distance, and the irrationality. The hatred doesn't make sense. So, again, Jews have been expelled, whether at universality, it's the Christians and the Arabs, who are second-class citizens. The Jews have always been forced to flee. Intensity, of course, the Holocaust is probably the biggest. And then just there are a whole bunch of councils, the Christians, all throughout the years, they have prohibited marriages. Not that we're upset with that, but prohibited from being treated by Jewish doctors. They can't live in their homes. You can't. Jews were required to pay taxes. Medical care was you had to wear a yellow badge. They can't universities. Jews lost their right to exist. God rejected the Jews. They're suffering justly, and they're allowed to be humiliated and persecuted because they're condemned by Hashem. This is what they all believed, and this is what spurred them on, among other things. Crusades. What do we have? The economic factor. The Jews were forced into money lending. They couldn't. They were out of all trades and the guilds, and the money lending. So you know, even though money lending was what sparked business, you know, the rulers realized it. The kings for sure realized this, but the people that owed the money to the Jews and other agendas. Because I owe the Jew money, the country will exist. They owe the Jew money that caused them to kill Jews. They just give them stereotypes, blood libels, just like Jews take Christian kids and take their blood. Just the most ridiculous thing. It's also for irrationality. Blood libels, transubstantiation. They came up with this thing that the wafer in the church is the Yashka. Just it's hard to understand what they believe, but then they believed when they found it eaten or taken or destroyed, it was the Jews that did it. And the Jews couldn't get into the church. There's no way, but it was the Jews that did it.
Do you think it was Yashin?
Maybe that's why it wasn't Yashin. You know, I don't know. But, you know. Pretext, yeah, Middle Ages, they killed God, they killed all these different things, what they say about the Jews, and as a result of that, they were burnt in 1247, 1389, over 100 instances of charges have been recorded in many places leading to massacres, where they would take the Jews and torture them until they got whatever they wanted from them. Ah, you see, they did it. Okay, more host desecrations, these are a whole list of places where they accused the Jews of eating the wafers or spilling out the wine or whatever it was that was there. Intensity. Again, expulsions. Again, the same idea, but you see it just from the point of the intensity. Now the longevity, we don't have to just go through this. It's been from nothing's changed. Everything from early as the Greeks and Roman empires to the Nazis and Soviets as well as the Arabs today. List of empires against the Jews: Egyptian, Chaldean, Babylonian, Greek, Roman, Byzantine, Spanish, Ottoman, British, Austro, German, French, Russian, Soviet, Nazi. Okay, no shortage of there. Irrationality. We hate them because they killed God. Come on. How do you deal with that? They were a cursed race. They didn't accept Yashka. They refused Christianity. Dioxide, again, they drink the blood of non-Jewish children. Well poisoning, air poisoning. That's it's just irrational what they believe. The host, like the infidel, sins, allies, killers, Easter week, blame Jews for crucifixion, sheer guilt. It's interesting. In the Jews are capitalists, and yet they're the biggest communists. Like what are they? Whatever you don't want them to be, they're the scapegoat. They're responsible for the Germany losing the war. I mean, Germany lost World War I, so they needed a scapegoat. So who was the scapegoat? The Jews. It's their fault they sold us out. Okay, many nations hurt themselves. Okay, Spain, like they destroyed themselves. Spain, they had a, I guess what they call it, a brain drain. You know, when all the Jewish people, they left. You know, and that's it. In Germany also, they either killed them, put them in concentration camps, or they kicked them out of their country. You know, they say that Germany was not far from getting the bomb. It was a race who couldn't come up with the atom bomb first. And the German scientists, Jewish-German scientists, were very much in on Albert Einstein, for one, who was in Germany. You know, things could have been different. But to their own destruction. Irrationality. I mean, today, Protocols of the Elders of Zion. It's the most, you know, I had somebody that said, if you are not religious, the only thing that makes sense is the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. Because basically, the Protocols of the Elders of Zion basically says that it's a book that the Jews get together every 100 years, and they plot the course of history for the next 100 years. That's what it says. That's what the book. And the book is where the meeting was. You know, a lot of it, maybe it was this meeting with the Jews met here and they met over here, and it's just, that's it. Today, it's being, Saudi Arabia is the biggest distributor of this book. It's been, I don't know how many languages it say over here. It's been printed in hundreds of languages, every language you can imagine. And I forgot which year it was, it was the second bestseller in the world book. Sold the most copies after the Bible. The Bible, the Protocol of the Elders of Zion. Probably this was like in the late 1800s.
Who wrote it?
I don't remember the name of it. But it's been I don't know who wrote it. But I wouldn't be surprised if it's been changed, constantly updated. To fit the... So that's the irrationality. It's like a crazy. If they're poor, if they're rich, they're thieves and they extort. If they're poor, they're the victim of ridicules. If they take sides in the war, it's because they wish to gain advantage. If they say peace, it's because they're scared. Whatever they say, the Jews can never win. This is capitalistic or revolutionary. Any regeneration. Okay, light to the nations. This is unbelievable. So now with what everything you saw, the Jews are a light. The Torah says the Jews will be a light to the nation. This week's parsha. You will be made into a great nation, and I will make your name great. And I will bless in you all the people, and whoever curses you will be cursed. And the entire world, all the families in the world will be blessed by you.
That's why a lot of the Christians like us. Not the Catholics, but the Christians.
Okay, yeah.
They love Aravacha. That's the
My contract is
this. I don't care if those they pay the bills and they donate to
Israel.
That's it, yeah.
My contract is,
Jews do
my contract has said the same thing. He says you're blessed when you deal with Jews. So, okay.
I got to deal with the right one.
That's it. Okay. So, also, if you obey me, keep my covenant, you shall be a special treasure among the nations. The world is mine. You will be a kingdom, a priest, and a holy nation to me. Different psukim. So, again, this is the psukim that the Torah is calling it. The Lord could write this prophet Isaiah, will establish you as a covenant people, a light unto the nations. This is the Amli Argayim. This is the famous words. You get it. The light unto the nations comes from Yeshaya. Okay. This comes from Mark Twain, I think. He is prominent on the planet as any other people. His commercial importance is extravagantly out of proportion of the smallness of his bulk. His contributions to the world's list of great names in literature, science, art, music, finance, medicine, and abstruse learning are also way out of proportion to the weakness of his stomach. This is all before the Nobel Prizes. This is like before that. How can you imagine a small group such as profound? The two approaches, which seem to have some precedent, them are conquest. Or proselytization, right? So how do you become great? You either conquest or you proselytize. You know, you try to get them to become like you, of which the Jews have not done any. They don't have an army. They don't do conversion. Most hated people, few in number, and dispersed. Okay, be a light to the nations. The most influential idea for ethical monotheism. I don't know if I have it on the thing, but the slide over here, but they did, I think it was the New York Times, did an article of who are the four, in modern times, the four people that had the biggest impact on humanity. Four people that had the biggest impact on humanity, which was Darwin, Einstein, Freud, and Marx.
Three to four.
Three of them are Jews, and one of them was wrong. All right, but in any case, but light into the nations, they brought the morality, you know, the idea, Christianity and Islam is all based on the Jews, love your neighbor. They stole a lot of our ideas, incorporated into theirs, and if you take a look outside the United Nations, beat their plows into swords into plowshares, again, it comes from Yeshaya. Over the past 150 years, first time Jewish history, Jews entirely disconnect from Judaism. So it knows that you may want to say that it has to do with the Torah and not the Jews. Right? But here we have, in the past 150 years, you have Jews that are not connected with the Torah, and they're still being a light to the world. So the Jews, it's the Jews that are a light to the world. And even not only in a Torah perspective, but even... So I do have it. Okay. Wall Street Journal. It wasn't the Times. Wall Street Journal, three-part series, and these were three out of the four. How is it likely that all three would turn out to be Jewish? Okay. I heard that Darwin was the fourth. But considering 0.5% of the world population, that would probably be 200 to 1. For if it's 8 million to 1, that all three of these people that they said would be Jewish. Okay. 1/5 of all Nobel Prize winners awarded since 1901 are Jewish. 1/5. In America, twice as likely to attend college as non-Jews. At Ivy League schools, about 23% of the students are Jewish. Jews comprise just 2% of the United States population. We went down a bit, right? I think we went down with less than 2 now. Numerous top colleges, Jews comprise in excess 30% of the students, 35% of Washington students, 30% of Emory students. Top leaders, both Russian and Hungarian revolutions were Jewish. 60% of the members of the Students for a Democratic Society, I don't know what that is, student organization, 60s. They said two most well-known student activists, yeah. Hoffman and Rubin, they said if you wanted to know, here it is, a survey, American Council of Education, they said the best single predictor of campus protests during the 60s was the presence of a substantial number of Jews and Jewish backgrounds.
Great. Good Yichus.
Yeah, Yichus, that's what we need. 40% of Peace Corps. 40% of the Peace Corps are Jewish. I don't know where that came from. But careers in Jewish are overrepresented. The Jews overrepresented at 231% in medicine. I don't know what that means. That means, I guess, proportion to non-Jews having doctors, Jews and doctors... We're 231%, 233 mathematics, 265 law, 300 dentistry, 479 psychology. 72% above the average.
Rabbis.
Huh? Rabbis. I don't even think we make that high.
What percentage of
rabbis? Like to the nations, 170 Jews and persons of half Jewish have been awarded the Nobel Prize. 200% of the worldwide, 37% of the United States. Scientific research fields, chemistry, 26. Okay, these are all different. Jews currently make up approximately 0.25% of the world population, 2% of the Jewish. Right. U.S. is 2%, but 0.25 doesn't make sense.
No,
it can't be. Probably it's 0.025%, if I'm missing a zero there. Chemistry, okay, these are just all the prize winners. Chemistry, 20 and 22, 13. Psychology, 52 prize winners, 9, 46. Country with significant medicine, geography, okay. Okay, now this is more for us during our time, medieval time, you had Jewish physician, I can't pronounce his name, of Basra, long list of translated Greek and Syrian works. So the truth is wherever, everything, all advancements, wherever the world was, the Jews were there. Whatever technology, whatever medicine, all through the generations. It wasn't like all of a sudden the Jews today decided, let's get into technology and medicine. But they were always there.
one of the things where the Jews were very into, Jews were always bilingual or multilingual. And, you know, when books were written in Rome, in Latin, in Greek, and then the Muslims needed them, so who were they going to get? They got Jews to translate it into Muslim. And then when Muslim books, Arabic, were written in Arabic, especially like the Rambam's works were, many of them were written in Arabic, so they were translated into Hebrew or into French by Jews. So the Jews always worked there. Needs to be first medical author in Arabic. Talmud is into Arabic. Okay. Leader of Spanish Jewish community. I'm in a physician. What is this? Okay, they make Arabic the scientific language. Right? This is what I was talking about. As when the Jews came, when after the Arabs conquered Spain in 711, so the caliphate that was there was very into education, and he opened the doors to Jews, and the Jews came, and that was the beginning of the golden age of Spain. Medieval, again, other things, the translations in Toledo, okay, you have all these. The Jews were represented in all parts. Sajigoan, these were philosophers. Actually, the Rambam wrote medical books that they were using for hundreds of years, translated in all different languages. Astronomers, Avraham Ben Chia, Levi Ben Gershon. Anybody hear of what's his name?
Gershon?
No, not Rabbi Gershon. I remember seeing his Vatora Sefer. Gershonides. Okay, these are different Jews there. Medicine, traditionally Jewish discipline. Research, disproportionate share of population, pharmacology. Jews were always into pharmacology, geometry, trigonometry. Maimonides, okay, 10 known medical works in Arabic, translated by Jewish medical ethics.
Wow.
Into English, yeah. Fred Rosner did that. Art of culture, Hippocrates, medical, okay, again. These are all of these, what the Maimonides wrote on asthma, poisons, antidotes, health, explanation of fits, glossary of drug names. He did this in his spare time when he wasn't taking care of the sultan and his harem and leading the Jewish community in Egypt and writing the Yad HaZaka and the Moran Avukim and answering shilas from all over the world. What did he do in his spare time? He wrote medical books. Okay. And the truth is, it says that the Rambam, the reason he got into medicine is because he needed to make a living. He was supported by his brother for a good part of his life. His brother was the businessman, he was doing the learning, and then his brother went on a business trip and got lost at sea. So now he had to support his family and his brother's family. That's how he got into medicine. All right. Levi Ben Gershonides. How did I say it? We have the astrolabe. The astrolabe, which is, this is already starting to help with sea exploration, because if you needed good star maps and how to read the stars and how high it is, and the Jews were into that. The best star maps and the best reading of the astrolabe and the Jacob's staff was another thing. These were all came. Jews were very, very prominent into this. Okay, the last one is interdependence of the second to last one, interdependence of Jewish people in the land of Israel, and it says, and I've come down to rescue them from Egypt. I will bring them out of the land to a good, spacious land. So that's it. So they're going into a good land. Even up to the time of Josephus, it was still very prosperous. So for the first 1,300 years, the Jews were in the land. The land was just overflowing with bounty. The whole area is excellent crop and pasturing. And, okay, this is all from Josephus. It just goes on. Then it says in the Vashimosi, Anias Aretz, Hashem will lay Ivechem Ayoshem Ba. So devastated will I leave the land that your enemies who live there will be astonished. Your land will remain desolate and your cities in ruins. In the Tochacha, that's what it says about Eretz Yisrael. During 2,000 years, there were fights and wars, and it was the land bridge. This is the center of three continents, Africa, Asia, Europe, all come in at one point. You would want to settle there and make it But Mark Twain, this is the famous Mark Twain he visited in 1867. He traversed some miles desolate country whose soil is rich enough but given wholly to weeds. Silent, mortal expanse, desolation is not even imagination that can grace with the pomp of life in action. The further we went, the hotter the sun got, the more rocky and bare, repulsive and dreary the landscape became. This is 1867. This is already, but the Jews are first starting to come. This is the beginning of the Chol of Eitz Zion movements, and etc. Ramban, during all our exiles, our land will not accept our enemies. Okay? Return. And it says, and when they come, the Brachan Klala, and you will return to the land, and Hashem will gather you. Oh, this is the seventh one. I'm sorry. Okay. I didn't realize. We're going to the seventh. The seventh one is just a prediction that the Jews are coming back. Now, who would ever think? How could it possibly be that the Jews will ever make it back there with Israel? After one nation and the other, and each nation, whoever had it, was, I mean, at times they were nice to the Jews, and sometimes they changed their minds and they were not. And that's really what this is again, it says you'll come back and you'll inherit the land again. And other people went to exile. This is nobody has a history like us. And Hashem called it, the Torah calls it. Okay, and turn to the Jewish people, as long as you do the land, does not give its produce. When she begins to flourish, however, when she came back, all of a sudden, the amazing thing is the land just started coming back. I just want to say that I remember, I came back, I went there for my first year in 1982. In 1981, they had just took apart Yamit. Yamit was a settlement in the Sinai Desert. Because they had decided to give it away to Egypt, They had to dismantle. So I happened to have been lucky. I just, you know, on one of our TLM that my yeshiva set up, was one of the tour guides who was in Yamit. He said that they were growing produce in desert, on sand and not soil. They were exporting 30%. Of their produce. The trucks were coming in 24/6, you know, just one after another, and like just to take the stuff and the produce, and you know, that's, they gave that all away. But just an amazing thing. You take a look today, just wherever you see such beauty in Eretz Yisrael. Okay, this is a coincidence. So again, that's the agenda to show you that the Torah is real and true. We will continue to see that when we get to this period of history, this is a period of history that the 1300s is like nothing good. What is good is the Torah and the learning and the transmission of learning that comes out of the most horrendous situations. We ended off last year with the Black Plague and the expulsions and everything that was going on. And if anything you see from over here, the idea that we're still around today, so just, I wanted to put it into context of the seven wonders of Jewish history. So that's a... So, Mr. Hashem, next week, I hope to start with England, because England is also very finite. They came in with the Normandies in the 1000s, and they were thrown out in 1292. That's it. And didn't come back until the 1600s. All right, so thank you very, very much.
God willing, next week.